Thanks so much, Eunice. Do keep Bibles open or the reading on the sheet. We're going to look at that in a bit of detail. We're in this series looking at the life of Jacob, and we've got to this stage in Jacob's life, chapter 28. A famous passage, Jacob's ladder. There's some headings on the inside of the sheet, but ordinarily we put that go along with it. So if you do have access to the slides, that will be extra on the slides as well. And the question on the first slide is raising the whole issue of heaven feels closed to us, when it feels like a shut door. And it's not just non-Christians who say they have that kind of experience. All kinds of people say that they know what that feels like. Perhaps for you, you know, you feel you're just not the Christian or the religious type. I know a friend I grew up with. We grew up in the same Christian youth group. And he said that for everyone else in the youth group, it looked like faith seemed so easy. But for him, it was like a subject at school that he was no good at. And so he did what, you know, everyone does with subjects they're no good at. You give up theoretical physics as soon as you can. And that's what he did with the Christian faith. For others of us, perhaps faith is something that we've tried once in our lives and it didn't work. You know, we prayed and God didn't come through for us. And so we said, oh, well, I'm giving this up. For some of us, the problem isn't so much that we think God has failed as we know the problem is in us. We know our own lives. We know we made a hash of things. And it just feels like it's too late now. We can't put right what's gone wrong. And, you know, at best, we feel like we're God's little disappointments. And that's all that's left to us. Now, today we are looking at a moment in Jacob's life. And Jacob has this experience of feeling like heaven is closed to him. And what we're going to see in this passage is how God intervenes. He stages an intervention in Jacob's life. And even though actually Jacob isn't really seeking God, God breaks in and takes hold of his life. And on the sheets there or on the screen, if you've got it in front of you, I've divided this passage into three main chunks. So into the mess of our sin is one. The Lord comes down to us too, so we can entrust ourselves to him. And let's begin with number one, into the mess of our sin. So in our passage, begins with these two verses, verses 10 and 11, and in a very short space that the writer Moses, he captures this sense of utter hopelessness that Jacob feels. So look at verse 10. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran, and he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. So if you know the story so far, Jacob is on the run. His brother Esau, his twin, wants to kill him. And it's not altogether surprising. Jacob has actually brought this whole situation on himself. He tricked his brother out of his inheritance, and he's now living with the consequence of his own selfish actions. And the place names are very relevant here. Two generations ago, so Jacob's dad is called Isaac, his grandfather is called Abraham. Jacob's grandfather Abraham lived in a place called Haran. He was living a dead-end life, worshipping idols. And God intervened and he led Abraham out of Haran into the promised land of Canaan. And now you'll see on the diagram, if you've got the slides, Jacob is on a journey in the other direction. He's fleeing the promised land and he's reversing the purposes of God. He's basically taking the whole Genesis story back to square one, effectively. And this is why it is a scene of utter hopelessness. There's no future for Jacob, no direction. He's going back to square one. Maybe Jacob at one time in his life, he thought God had grand purposes for him. You'll remember if you've been in this series, there was a prophecy given over Jacob when he was before he was even born, actually, that although he was the youngest of the twins, he would know the Lord's special blessing on him, and he would have known about that prophecy. And perhaps he felt, you know, he'd been doing his best. He'd been trying to pursue the blessing of God in his own way. And yet somehow he looks at his life and it is all unraveled. And now here he is in this desperate situation with nothing. Where is God in this situation? Perhaps he feels like faith was a subject at school that he was just no good at. And so he said, sack it. And it's also a picture, just these two verses, of Jacob being not just hopeless, but utterly alone. Jacob is on a journey, but the place he's arrived at is basically Nowhereville. It's actually described in verse 11 as a certain place. I mean, the whole point about this place is it doesn't have a name. It's a nowhere. And it's a place with no hospitality. You know, a wanderer in those sort of places, they would look for somewhere of safety, but there's nowhere of safety. No human contact of any kind at all. Jacob had grown up desperate for his love, and yet he knew right from the beginning that his brother was the favorite. And we've seen in the story so far that Jacob had literally dressed up as his brother in order to try and hear his father say, well done, and get the father's blessing from him. And I just wanted us to inhabit that for a moment. Imagine what that would do to you. The only way I can get my father's approval is by literally pretending I'm someone else. Imagine what that has done inside him. And of course, we know the whole story backfired, and Jacob ended up with nothing. He's lost his father. His father has sent him away. He's lost his brother. His brother wants to kill him. He's even lost his mother. His mother was the only one who ever loved him, but he's never going to see his mother again. And we get here just this picture, not just of hopelessness, but of utter aloneness. Here he is with no one in the world. And then finally, these verses, these two verses, give us a picture of powerlessness. He's defenseless. And we get that in the picture of a stone being used as a pillow. And that is a very clear way of saying, here is a guy who has got nothing. Even if you go camping, if you've got any kind of spare garment, anything is better than a stone, isn't it? You just roll up anything, whatever you've got, but he's got nothing. This is how destitute he is. No shelter, no protection, utterly powerless. And here is a guy who has lost everything. You know, heaven is closed to him. He's hopeless. He's alone. He's powerless. And perhaps the worst of it all is that deep down he knows it's all his own doing. Deep down he knows that it's his own sin that got him to this place. And he's stuck. There's nothing he can do now. He's just alone. And yet, I mean, just into this desperate situation, thankfully it's not the end, into the mess of our sin, we discover, and this is point two, that the Lord comes down to us. And that's what we see here in verse 12. And Jacob dreamed, verse 12, and behold, we're going to get three beholds, three things to see. Behold, there was a ladder. If you're following it in the Bibles, there's a footnote and it says, or a flight of steps set up on the earth. And the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, that this is the second behold. Behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on the flight of steps or the ladder. Actually, I think flight of steps is probably a better translation than ladder, mainly because the stairway we discover is wide enough, isn't it, for a whole stream of God's angelic messengers to be passing each other on it. So it's not this kind of ladder we saw earlier. It's something quite impressive, something big. And what Jacob has had his eyes open to here, he's been unaware of it up until now, but he's had the veil pulled back and he discovers there is an unseen world and it is frantic with activity. And he sees God's agents, these angels, effecting God's purposes across the world. There they are coming down to do the assignments God sends them on. And then when they're done up, they go again up the stairway. And behold, verse 13, this is the third behold, the Lord stood above it. And if you're following in the Bible, the footnote says, or beside him. It could be above it, it could be above him, grammatically speaking. So the Lord is either above the stairway, he's at the top of it, Or, and I think this is more likely, the Lord is above Jacob. So he's standing over Jacob as he sleeps at the bottom of the stairway. And I think the latter is more likely, that God is was after the dream, when Jacob wakes up, this is in verse 16, the first thing he says is, surely the Lord is in this place. Do you see the point? Lord is here at the bottom with me. And I think what Jacob has discovered here is, though heaven seemed closed, it felt like a locked door, felt bolted shut, inaccessible, wonderfully, God has come down to him. Actually, another thing which confirms that is the better reading, that it's not just God is up there looking down, but he's come down, is the way this passage connects and contrasts with another passage that we've already looked at in the book of Genesis. Lots of us will know the story of the Tower of Babel. I've got a little picture of it on the slides to give you a sense of it. It's a story in Genesis 11 about a bunch of builders, and they say in chapter 11, verse 4, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And it's a picture of human religion. It's a picture of humanity's proud assumption that if we can just try hard enough, we will be able to get up to God. We'll be able to climb our way into God's house. And that's the message of many of the religions of today. If you can just, and fill in the gap, keep the five pillars or follow the eightfold path, if you can just keep these standards, if you can be a good little Christian, whatever it is, that will get you up the ladder to God. And the next verse, as we follow Genesis 11, the writer Moses, he makes a little joke about the absurdity of this whole approach. And it says in chapter 11, verse 5, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the idea is, it's a subtle joke, isn't it? It's saying that even though they think there's this grand tower and it's so tall, any day now they're going to arrive at their destination, they're going to storm heaven, we can get there. Actually, from God's perspective, the tower is so insignificant, so pathetic, that God has to come down. Where was it now, that tiny little thing? It's so feeble and pathetic that, you know, he has to look for it and say, oh, bless. Oh, look, that's so cute. You thought you could get to me by building some stairs. Oh, yeah, that's not going to work. And actually, there's another joke at the tower builder's expense at the end of the passage as well. This is the origin story of Babylon, this great empire. It gets called Babel and then Babylon, Babylon. And in their language, Babel means the gate of God. And you can hear there, you know, the grand claim. We're going to get there. We're going to God's dwelling place. This will be the gateway into God's presence. And Moses, he retells the story, but he gives a better comic explanation for what Babel actually means. And what happens is God confuses their language. And it says in verse 9, therefore its name was called Babel or Babel, and it sounds like the Hebrew word for confused, like we might say their empire is called Babel, Babel, Babel. It was just confused language. They thought it meant gateway to God, but Moses said, no, actually what it means is just confusion, babbling. And it's a cheeky joke Moses is making about how ridiculous human empires really are. They are not a gateway to God. They are Babel, Babel land. They are just confusion city. They're not achieving anything. It doesn't work, that approach. And this episode, our chapter, chapter 28, is a deliberate compare and contrast. We're meant to think about chapter 11. You see, the builders thought they could create a Babel, a gateway to God. They thought they could ascend by their works, their power, their wisdom. But the whole thing was a waste of time. It was colossally expensive, and yet it was a dead end. It was like the HS2 between Manchester and Birmingham. The whole thing cost a lot of money, and it didn't do anything. And actually what happens is God ends up judging them for their rebellious pride, and the whole thing is useless. Whereas chapter 28 is the opposite, isn't it? Here we have the true gateway of heaven. That's what Jacob calls this in verse 17. And the point is that this time it's the other way. The initiative is all from God. It's not bottom up, it's deliberately top down. Instead of humans trying to climb our way up, which is actually impossible and prideful even to attempt it, here with Jacob, God comes down to us. And instead of it being, you know, in the city of man, the center of an empire, Babylon, built by those trying to make a name for themselves, the point is this gateway is in Nowhereville. It's in a place that God chooses. And actually a place where proud and important people wouldn't even think to look. This is the contrast. And that's why I think it's a better translation to say the Lord stood beside him in verse 13. The Lord has come down to him. He's at the bottom of the ladder. It's the opposite of climbing up to God. God comes down to us. There's a story about the writer C.S. Lewis, and he was attending a conference, and it was all about comparative religion, comparing different religions. And several people were trying to debate what was unique about the Christian religion over against the others. And numerous suggestions were put out there. And eventually C.S. Lewis piped up and he said, "What's unique about Christianity? That is very easy. It's grace." He said, "One word makes the difference." And he was trying to say Christianity is not about us climbing our way up to God. As I put on the diagram on the slides, it's about God coming down to us. That is what Christians celebrate at Christmas time, isn't it? It's the opposite of human religion. It's God coming down to us. That's what the theme verse that we began with said. Do you remember Jesus said in John 1, it's on the front of your sheets, "Truly I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." So Jesus says in that verse, "I am the stairway. I'm the ladder that Jacob saw. I am the one link between heaven and earth. I am the down-to-earth God. I'm the one who has come down to you. And therefore anyone can now have access to God through me." That's what Jesus is claiming in that verse. You may know that when Jesus arrived, his message to the world was this: repent and believe the gospel, which is a translation of good news. And there is a world of difference, isn't there, between good advice and good news. Our world is full of good advice. Every ideology is just hitting us with good advice all the time. Do this, try this, this will solve your problems in your life. And we get thrown all this advice constantly, and it is exhausting. And what a contrast that is with good news. That's what gospel means. It's not good advice about what you have to do. It is good news about what God has done, finished, done. And of course, the good news is, this is the heart of what we hold so dear, is although we couldn't fix the relationship with God, we couldn't get up to him, we couldn't bridge the divide, God has come down to us. And as Jesus died and rose again in our place, he fixed the relationship himself. He's done it all. And what Jacob discovers is not simply that God comes down to us, but as I've put on the sheets and you can see on the slides, he comes to us in our hopelessness and he gives us instead promise. He comes to us in our aloneness and he gives us his presence. And he comes to us in our powerlessness and he gives us his protection. So there's a mirroring of those three. Let me hit each one by one. First, the Lord comes down to us with his promise. Look at verse 13. "And behold, the Lord stood above it," or better, beside him, "and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north, to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed." For Jacob, and if you've been following the story with us, this is a confirmation that the promise which was first given to his grandfather, to Abraham, and then it was given to his dad, to Isaac, Now we discover it's being given to him, to Jacob, and then to his offspring. And as we've seen already in this series, this is the gospel promise. The New Testament calls this promise the gospel, the promise that God will bring blessing to the whole world through one of Abraham's seed, through Christ ultimately. And this promise, this certain hope, is a game changer. For Jacob, from this moment on, everything in his life is going to be completely different and yet also the same. Let me try and explain that. Everything is going to be the same in Jacob's life. He's still got the same circumstances, the same difficulties. He's still on this road out to Haran. But everything is going to be different in his life from now on because he knows how the story's going to end. One writer describes this dynamic by asking us to imagine two workers who go to work on a factory production line. And there's two of them, and the first one is told, at the end of the year, you're going to get paid £10,000. The other is told, you've got to do the same job on the production line. At the end of the year, you're going to get £10 billion. You're going to get the whole factory owner's inheritance given to you. How does that impact the two workers? Well, you could say not very much. You know, they've still got to go to work on Monday morning. They've still got to work on the production line. It's hard work. It's long hours. But at another level, everything is completely different. And the second worker, he goes to work every day whistling. And there's a spring in his step and a buoyancy to him. He can afford to be generous. He's not got his elbows out with the other fellow workers. He befriends them. He helps them. He's generous. Everything's changed in his demeanor because what has changed? Well, he has a promise. He has hope in his life. It's a silly illustration, but it's a little glimpse of the difference which the gospel promise makes when it lands in a person's life. Everything changes and nothing changes. It completely radically transforms us, even though in many respects our circumstances look very similar. So as Jacob discovers, the Lord comes down to us with his promise, and next the Lord comes down with his presence. Look at verse 15. The Lord says, "Behold, I am with you. I am with you." A couple of weeks ago, the other Andrew Satch, he and I had to go to quite a difficult meeting. We'd taken a stand on something within our denomination, and we had to go to a meeting where we were going to get a hard time, basically, for it. It was going to be very awkward and difficult. And we both remarked to each other afterwards how much easier it is going into that situation with a buddy, a partner in crime, someone who is with you. And I guess all of us know that situation. You know, you're in that situation at work, or you're the only Christian in your year at school, whatever it is. But there's somebody who gets it, who's with you in it, and that makes all the difference. And it is a comfort. It is lovely having an ally. But the Christian has far more than that. The Christian is never alone, even when there's no other human allies with us. The Apostle Paul says in 2 Timothy 4, "At my trial, no one came to stand by me," completely deserted in a court of law. And then he says, "But the Lord stood by me and strengthened me." That is the promise to Christians. We are never alone, even though it feels like it. We talked in chapter 26, if you're with us, about how God's presence with us is, in one sense, the greatest of all God's promises. And we thought about that picture of the Gruffalo. You know, when the Gruffalo walks through the forest with the little mouse, the mouse has nothing to fear. And that is the Christian's life. We have God, we have the most powerful one in the universe with us. And therefore, there's nothing left to fear. And that's how this promise gets pushed right through the scriptures. So Joshua, you know, "Be strong and courageous, Joshua." Why? "For the Lord your God is with you." If God is with you, you've got nothing to fear. Or think of Psalm 23, King David. "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil." David, how is it you won't fear even death? "For you are with me." It's the promise of God's presence revolutionizes every situation, even death. God can get us through death if he is with us. It is the highest promise, highest privilege a human being can receive. The Lord of the universe with us today and for eternity. All his resources behind us for our ultimate good. And this is the promise that gets given to Jacob here. I am with you. So that we've had Jacob discovering the Lord coming with his promise, with his presence, and finally with his protection. Look at verse 15. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I've done what I've promised you. So a promise of protection right to the end. On the slides, I've got a little slide coming up about a picture of an exile and a picture of an exodus. And it's difficult to tell the difference between an exile and an exodus when you're in the middle of it. Now, I have to explain what I mean there. Jacob is going to be cut off. He's going to be away from the promised land for the next 20 years, right from here until chapter 35. It's going to be a terrible time of his life, a time of oppression. He's going to get mistreated and abused by his uncle Laban, basically treated as a slave. And to Jacob, it could easily feel like a time of punishment, a time of exile. Do you remember Adam at the beginning of Genesis? He was exiled. He was sent out, expelled from the garden, cast out because of his sin. That's an exile. But as we read on in the story, we're going to discover that for Jacob, it's really a time not of exile, but of exodus, a time of protection and liberation. And actually the whole story, and we're going to see this as we read on, is going to be framed like the story of Israel's exodus. If you know the story of Israel's exodus, Israel was oppressed by Pharaoh until Moses declares to him, "Let my people go." Pharaoh ultimately refuses. Israel escapes, plunders the oppressors, the Egyptians, and the Egyptians then pursue them before Israel escapes through the Red Sea and heads for Mount Sinai. And we're going to see that exact pattern in the life of Jacob. Jacob is going to say to Laban, his oppressor, "Send me away that I may go to my country." Laban is going to refuse. Jacob is going to plunder his uncle. Laban is going to give chase, you know, going after Jacob. Jacob will escape across a huge river and then head off to a particular mountain. And even, you know, as you read the story, you're thinking, oh, this sounds very much like the Exodus story. And that's deliberate. The whole Jacob narrative is being told in an exodus-y way. And part of what we're to learn here is the difference it makes when God gives us his promise and his presence and his protection in the middle of the hard times. He's still got the hard times. He's still got this difficult situation with Laban ahead of him. But now it's not going to be the experience of exile. It's going to be the experience of exodus. At one level, the circumstances are going to be very, very similar. It's going to be 20 hard years for him. But right at the outset, he's being told God is with him. God is for him. He's working for his good through all the trials that are going to come. He's protecting him. And therefore, Jacob is going to be like that guy on the production line. You know, the one who knows that at the end of the year it's going to be okay. And that is a game changer. And that means that, you know, we as believers, we can rejoice in our sufferings. That's how Paul puts it in Romans, or James puts it, consider it pure joy when we meet trials. We still meet the same difficulties, but it's not exile, it's exodus. We know that ultimately God is going to use even the hard times, even the times in Haran, for our good. Revelation of God. He's learnt that the Lord comes down to him in grace, and therefore he discovers that we can entrust ourselves to this God. And I'm just going to give us three quick take-homes from this passage. And the first thing is, start where you are. I think quite a lot of people, I've read some commentators on this passage, and most people are very negative about how Jacob responds to God in verse 20. It's quite a contrast. So God comes into Jacob's life. He doesn't condemn him. He doesn't set any conditions. He just stands over Jacob and he speaks over him love and grace and acceptance over this guy. And yet Jacob's response to God is a bit different. It does contain a condition. It has an if clause. Look with me at verse 20. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And I think we're meant to notice this isn't the best response that Jacob could have given. I mean, compare it, for example, with his grandfather Abraham, you know, all in right from the start. This is a bit tentative, you could say, a little bit cautious at least. And I think this is actually strangely encouraging for us. Because what it's telling us is that we don't need to have, you know, a perfect response ready of total confidence in God in order to reach out to him. What Jacob does here is he starts where he is. And he says, yeah, I think I can trust you, God. I'm going to make a start on that basis. And for some of us here, that is exactly what we need to hear. We don't need to wait until some, you know, future time when we've got every question answered, when we're 100% sorted in our faith. What we're called to do is just start the conversation. Yes, Lord, I want to start this thing. Please help me. And let's take it from there. So that's the first thing. Start where we are. Secondly, worship the God of Bethel. So when God speaks to Jacob again in chapter 31, it's interesting the title God gives himself. God says to Jacob, I am the God of Bethel. And the point, I think, is that Jacob is now to relate to God on the basis of what God has just revealed here on this day in Bethel. That's what this whole place gets named in verse 19. So he's saying to him, remember, Jacob, I am that God. I'm the God who intervened when you were hopeless and alone and powerless. I didn't wait, did I, for you to be seeking me. I came down to you and I came and I spoke grace and love over you. I gave you my promise and my presence and my protection. This is who I am. I am the God of Bethel. And this is the basis on which you are always now to relate to me. This is who I am. And I think this is so helpful for us as we relate to God day by day. All of us are inclined to believe lies about God. That's what the serpent did from the beginning. You know, God is not generous. God is against you. He's not powerful. He won't, you know, it's just full of lies being fed all the time. And we quickly slip into wrong views about God. And we think he's this, you know, headmaster figure who's fierce, or you know, he's the policeman who's tut-tutting, or you know, he's waiting for us to slip up, or waiting for us to sort our lives out before we can come back to him. There's all these lies about God, and God says, now I want you to relate to me on the basis of who I actually am. I'm the God of Bethel. Embed this in your memory, Jacob. I am the down-to-earth God. I'm the God who comes after you. And of course, for us, we know this even more clearly. The God of Bethel is the God of the Lord Jesus Christ, who comes down to us and speaks grace and love over us. And the final take home, so worship the God of Bethel. Finally, open your eyes. In verse 16, when Jacob wakes up, he says this, surely the Lord is in this place. And I did not know it. It's an interesting phrase. The Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And I think part of what this passage is teaching us is that there's a lot more going on around us than you can see, than you can see with your natural eyes at least. And this is one of those moments, and there are a few moments like this in the Bible, when God pulls back the veil and he shows us reality as it truly is, the things that we would otherwise miss. And of course, the reason he does it is because he wants to let us in on reality, on the full picture, not just this little partial picture that we get with our natural eyes. So, for example, and I'll put a slide up with a picture of this situation, but in 2 Kings 6, there's a famous place where Elisha is surrounded by an enemy army. He's in a city and, you know, he's in real danger. and his servant is terrified. You know, he just sees this army surrounding them. And Elisha prays that his servant would have his eyes opened. And in that moment, the Lord opens the servant's eyes and he sees not just the army that's about to attack them, but another army, a much bigger heavenly army that is there protecting them. And suddenly that makes everything okay because he can see the reality of what's really going on. And that's, you know, the situation for us. We can see perhaps the threats, but we need to see with the eyes of faith that God has got this. He's bigger than that. Or there's another place in the Bible, and we're going to look at this in the autumn term, called the Transfiguration. And God pulls back the veil and he shows his disciples Jesus in all his glory, his dazzling, you know, white glory. He's just shining like the sun. His clothes are whiter than anyone could launder them, it says. And it's a little picture that Jesus, although most of the time they just saw him as this, you know, grubby man walking around dusty streets, actually, underneath, he was the majestic king who will return in terrifying glory. And they got a glimpse of it so that they could live the rest of the time on the basis of that reality. And that is what it is to live as a Christian. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4 that we're to look not simply at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. This is what it is to live by faith, to live on the basis of reality as God declares it. And this passage was a lesson for Jacob to open his eyes. It's a lesson for us to open our eyes and to live in this world on the basis of the full picture so that we can live wisely. So we started with that question, what about when heaven feels closed to us? Perhaps, you know, we feel faith is a subject at school that we're not very good at, or, you know, we feel like we've blown it with God and we're just going to be God's little disappointment. And the wonderful truth of this passage is that even in the midst of this mess caused by our sin, God reveals himself as a God who comes down to us. He comes down in grace. And we know this even more deeply than the first readers of Genesis, because we've seen that Jesus really did come from heaven to earth. He came down to us to pursue us. And that is a game changer, because it means we can entrust ourselves to him and walk with him, even though sometimes it feels like exile. It's actually exodus. We can trust him. I've put a couple of questions for you on the sheets, but why not let's take a couple of minutes now, just in the quiet, reflecting on what the Lord is saying to us in this passage, and then we'll have our prayers and later on the Lord's Supper.